right now. Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as per usual, is James.
What up?
Okay. Before we get started, check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We've done podcasts on a lot of really good movies recently. Silence of the Lambs, Vertigo, Memento, and Nightcrawler. It's a good last four, and Gone Girl was the one before that. Yeah, we don't know what we're talking about next week, but you can fill the time with all our old podcasts at themacguffinmen.com. Also, follow us on Twitter, also at themacguffinmen. Yeah, and subscribe to us on iTunes, and give us 5 stars, and tell all of your friends and minor acquaintances to give us 5 stars. Yeah, let's just get right to it.
Dad, why did you name me after something that's bad?
Oh, we didn't.
Murphy's Law.
Murphy's Law doesn't mean that something bad will happen. It means that whatever can happen, will happen.
All right, James.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
No man.
No, it's pronounced no land.
Good. I was having problems with that pronunciation on the last episode. We are at long last talking about Interstellar.
Indeed.
You are a big Nolan fan?
Yeah. I was thinking about this. I'm pretty sure the MacGuffin Men's favorite director is Christopher Nolan, like as a collective. Like if there was some way to quantify our love for directors and add it together, I think it's Nolan.
But that's only because you love him more than you love anything.
Well, it's just because of all the directors that all those, like, that group of directors that's very good. I think it's just sort of between the two of us, we'd like him the most, you know? Like, I like Fincher way more than you do, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Okay, so let's
great
talk
start
about
to this podcast. Yeah, let's talk about Interstellar. Well, I don't know. Do you want to know my thoughts, or do you want to know the thoughts of the woman that was bawling behind me?
Oh, give me both, please. I think I know what she felt about it.
Oh my god, there were a couple of moments in this movie where she was just gone. She was lost.
So she for sure had children.
Unquestionably. the moment when they get back from the Wave Planet and their Cooper is looking at his messages from Tom and eventually Merv, the second he sits down you just hear ah! from behind, and she was like I think two rows behind me and like a few seats to the left, and that whole scene lost it. Bookcase world, lost her goddamn mind basically until the end of the movie, and it was great. It was really funny, and to the point where I was talking about her with strangers after the movie ended because I just heard people talking about her and I was like, oh, I'm getting in on this conversation.
Ooh, we're judging someone? I'm there.
Yeah, exactly. It's my favorite thing to do. Yeah, so that was my Interstellar experience.
Okay, you didn't really answer how you felt about it.
Oh, I think I like this movie a lot. If you ignore, basically stop paying attention anytime someone says the word love, I think this movie's really great.
Yeah, that is really the crux of this movie, though.
Yeah, I know. I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying if you're able to ignore the crux of this film, it's a very good film.
Okay, but is this the movie so good that you're okay with that? Or is it this movie is good and then it's bad for a little bit and then it's good again and you don't really forgive the whole thing?
Yeah, I think it's weird. I feel weird about this movie because I think it's so interesting and the things it does well, and the stuff with love is just so just not interesting and not good. And it's weird because there's this so much specificity involved with the science of this film, and then they just talk about love in the most broad strokes, and it just never comes together in a way that I find interesting. Like those two things, they don't meet well, you know. And that's the problem with this film. That said, I enjoyed the film immensely, and I think the things it does well are more than enough to make me really like it. Yeah.
And this isn't just because you're a robot not capable of love, right?
With my honesty setting to 100%, it is not just because of that. Although I do say, like, the ending of Inception, I feel like, is basically the line for as much emotion as I want in a movie. Like, that is the absolute fine line, and Nolan totally walked it there, and he stepped over it here. So maybe I am too robotic for Interstellar. Because basically any time your movie has scenes of people crying and confessing feelings, I'm checking out emotionally, you know? Like, that's easy.
Yeah, it is crazy. You kind of pointed out when you said it's so hyper specific about some of the science stuff and then so broad with some of the emotional stuff. I think it kind of is all over the place in that sense too. Like, it really is in a lot of ways kind of a cold film in the way that a lot of Nolan's movies are cold. But it seems like, as I said, like, love is the crux of this. It's built on a foundation of exploring, you know, the warmest feeling there is. And I don't know. It doesn't quite add up for me either.
Yeah, I kind of figured, judging by the text you sent me after you saw the movie.
What was that?
Just my favorite part of Interstellar is when I got a vote, or the end of Interstellar is when I got a voucher to see another movie.
Yeah, you've seen this more than once now, I assume.
Yeah, of course.
I liked it a lot more the second time.
I agree, because although I will say, very early on in the first the scene with the bookcase. I mean, the first shot of the movie is of that bookcase, so you know it's going to be important because Nolan knows the importance of a first shot. And immediately upon seeing that shot, I was like, oh, this is the beginning of The Prestige. This bookcase is important, you know. Yeah. And it's not hard to piece together early on in the film that the ghost is going to be McConaughey or Cooper. So I was just like, okay, all right, I'm just going to, like, not try and figure this movie out, which I suppose is kind of the way I treat movies. But I feel like knowing that so early on in the movie kind of helped me enjoy it the first time, because I kind of knew that I wasn't going to love that and had about 2 hours of prep time before it actually happened. And I don't know. I do certainly think I enjoyed it more the second time, because there is a lot to take in this film. It does not lack ideas, but the big ones, like we've discussed, just don't quite come together to me.
Yeah, I read a study comparing how people actually enjoy a movie with spoilers versus without it. And, you know, we always say that we don't want spoilers because it'll ruin our enjoyment of it. But they found that you usually do enjoy it more when you know the ending and you can just kind of appreciate the filmmaking and watch the story for what it is.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's why, I'm sure I've told you this before, that's why everything we do a podcast on, I watch twice. So once so that I can just sort of watch it as a movie, and then second time so I can watch it and look around, you know?
Yeah.
So I can explore.
Sure. Mm-hmm. This one, kind of some of the big problems watching it the second time, I knew they were there and I wasn't letting them upset me, and I could just enjoy the movie for how it looks, which is not this movie's problem at all. I had a big problem with the robots the first time through. I think robots are hard to do, and without them ever seeming goofy. Mm-hmm. And I don't think this movie totally nails it. It's like when Tars there speeds up to go save Anne Hathaway on the water planet. Yeah. It looks really goofy and then just begs the question, why aren't we just sending the robot out once we land every time?
That's the much bigger question to me. I don't care about it looking goofy, but it was just sort of, he's clearly faster than you.
And if he dies, he's a robot.
Well, one of the things I liked about the robots, and there are a couple moments in this movie that I think really kind of subvert film conventions that I really enjoy, particularly when Cooper shows up to NASA, gets detained, I suppose, and spends a good portion of time being terrified, and they just laugh at him for being terrified. Like, we're not some shadow agency, we're NASA. I thought that was really funny. really kind of set the tone for the type of movie you're in. It's not sort of this cloak and dagger sort of story. It's just this, I don't know, pretty much everything is what it seems, you know. Like, there are theories for most of these things, and NASA isn't some shadow agency, so Cooper shouldn't fear them. And the fact that the robots never turn against them, I thought was a really wonderful thing. Like, that the twist was that there was no twist with the robots, and I thought that was really cool and something that I got a kick out of watching the movie.
You really feel everything's what it seems in this movie? I think there's a fair amount of twists in this.
Well, I mean,
twist number one, Matt Damon's in it.
Did you not know Matt Damon was in this movie? I'm just curious because I did. I don't totally remember how I knew this, but I did know it. But it did certainly surprise a lot of people.
Yeah, I had no clue. And you and I were both highly anticipating this movie. Read a lot about it and, you know, just keep up to date with what was going on with it. But no, I never got that. And I love that. I love a legitimate surprise. Like, I love when they'll kill off a big actor early in a movie, and I love something like this. I can't even think of another comparison of a A-list actor showing up halfway through a movie that I didn't anticipate. But yeah, I thought it was great.
Perhaps Matt Damon and Saving Private Ryan.
But who?
Matt Damon and Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, I think we knew he was in that movie though.
Well, that thing was just, he became A-list while Saving Private Ryan was filming. That's that story. But anyway, yeah, I enjoyed it because Matt Damon's wonderful in everything. And I enjoyed that he was able to be in a Christopher Nolan movie without having to do any of the promotion that comes along with the Christopher Nolan movie. So good for him. And the other thing I enjoyed is that he's described as like the best of us in this film. And I think he was up for Harvey Dent when that role was being cast in The Dark Knight, a character that is also described as the best of us in that film. And I thought that was really funny. That's kind of where we can see how Nolan views Matt Damon. And I agree. Yeah, he's wonderful.
Yeah. And we get evil Matt Damon.
I know. Matt versus Matt. Dawn of Matstus.
Mm-hmm. Do we want to talk about the history of this movie at all?
Let's talk about it really quickly because
Everything
I've read about this movie recounts it in such a boring way. Steven Spielberg was going to direct this movie from a script by Jonathan Nolan. Spielberg backed out. Christopher Nolan read the script and was like, hey, I might like to make this. I'm going to rewrite it. Cool, Jonah? Okay, cool. Paramount, Warner Brothers, they do sort of a joint venture together, and we end up with Interstellar.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yes, I also did not want to go too deep on this, but I feel that's important to point out. I think we'll talk about Steven Spielberg and blockbusters later. So
yeah, okay.
Yeah, I thought that was important. And production, you want to talk about IMAX cameras for a bit? Or?
Well, yeah, since The Dark Knight, with the exception of Inception, which didn't shoot anything in IMAX, Nolan has increased the amount of actual IMAX footage he shot per film, and it's awesome. I highly recommend anybody check out, well, I guess Interstellar is the only one you have the opportunity to check out in IMAX now, and I mean like real IMAX, not just sort of the fake multiplex IMAX. There are very few IMAX screens that are actual IMAX screens, but they're
not IMAX.
Yeah, exactly, Aziz. But they're totally worth checking out. And yeah, that whole Matt Damon sequence, like the fight chase spinning, that whole sequence of the redocking, that whole thing for about an 18-minute stretch or however long it is all shot in IMAX, and it will blow your fucking mind. It's wonderful.
There is way more docking drama in this movie than I anticipated. Like, way, way more.
Although with space movies, I suppose there does tend to be quite a bit of docking involved. You know?
Yeah, but this was the most dramatic I had seen.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, anyway, IMAX is great, and yeah, good times.
Yeah, and, you know, all the theaters pretty much are switching over to digital, and this was one, you know, actually on film stock, so... Nolan really likes the kind of analog technologies, the practical stuff, and not just the film, but the way, you know, the effects were done in this film as well, right?
Yeah, did you see how many green screens were used on this movie? Did you see that number?
Yes.
And it's zero, and that makes me very happy.
Yeah, and I knew this about Nolan, that he likes to do everything practical. Like, if he can build a set or build an effect, that's what he wants to do, and so he gets to do it. But I've never heard of this whole process before. Do you want to explain it, how he avoided the green screens?
Yeah.
Which seemed like they would be almost the entire movie.
Well, like, for the, specifically when they're on the Endurance and all of their little spaceships throughout the film, they were in a studio, of course. They didn't have green screens wrapped around the sets, though, as would be the norm. They made these giant screens and actually projected stars on them. So what you're seeing through the windows in Interstellar, through the windows of the Endurance and whatnot, is actually there in camera. Another movie I know that did that recently was Oblivion, that Tom Cruise movie from last year. And okay. It added a lot. But yeah, it's just a cool, different way of doing things. And it's just sort of, I like it because it's not the fuck it, we'll fix it in post sort of idea. It's actually problem solving and knowing that you've solved the problem before you're in editing.
Yeah.
It just seems like a more honest way to inject some reality in your film. And we talked about this on the Memento podcast. Nolan doesn't like putting a camera in a space where that camera wouldn't fit. Like, he doesn't enjoy removing walls from sets to make things fit. He feels that there's always all of these levels of imperceptibility that the audience can pick up on, even if they're not thinking about it, that if just having the camera in the physical space that the actor is also in increases their attachment to the film. And I agree with that wholeheartedly. And I do think it's entirely it's very difficult to pick up on exactly what it is, but it does really increase this feel of realism, you know.
Yeah, and then with this method we were talking about of having the screens with the effects on it, it comes at the expense of having to create all the effects first, so you can put those on the screens for the actors to see, and, you know, as it seems like Nolan believes, kind of interact with them and be a bit more in that place and mm-hmm. get a better performance out of it. So, you know, it's not easy to do because normally you'd be shooting and then creating effects somewhere else at the same time. And this is one where you kind of had to get all that done and then create a better environment for the actors to act in. So, yeah, that's just one of the many things. Every time he does a movie, you'll read about him, you know, building sets instead of doing green screen, or in this case where you have to do green screen, making it a bit more practical and a bit more authentic for the actors and on these sets.
Yeah, exactly. And even using the sort of shuttles, kind of building them and using cranes and stuff to move them a bit. Obviously not in every shot, but and the bat in The Dark Knight Rises was a big sort of the first time Nolan really did this, building the ship and just sort of wheeling it around Los Angeles, you know. And in this case Iceland or wherever they're shooting. One quote, there was a recent New York Times profile on Nolan, and his post-production coordinator says that he had worked on romantic comedies with more visual effects shots than The Dark Knight Rises.
And did you hear about the miniatures that weren't so miniature?
No. I mean, you could tell that there was some sort of miniature work involved in this film, but I don't know their dimensions.
Yeah, so I guess a combination of 3D printing and just kind of old-fashioned hand sculpting and miniature carpentry, I guess. they made models of all the ships.
Okay,
the crew referred to them as maxatures because they were like 50 feet. Like, they were still huge, considering.
Yeah.
Like, the Endurance module is 25 feet, like that huge circle. So, again, just practical to get those details and, you know, to physically make this stuff to make it easier to, you know, to work with and see what it's really going to look like. And he's talked about this with Interstellar a lot, and people talk about this with other movies, and it's something that I always love in sci-fi movies when they do this, is to give it that kind of lived-in look. Like, it's not just the sleek white cleanliness of a lot of futuristic looking movies, like the
aforementioned Oblivion.
Yeah, exactly. Things are like scratched and dented and you know, really look like they have a physical strength to them. So that's, you know, again, kind of just going with what we're talking about of how he the green screen, just everything he can do to kind of make it a bit more analog and a bit more physical and just that kind of stuff. As you said, it's hard to pick apart exactly what it is about these things that look off. But he tries to even avoid having those small things that we can't even articulate.
Yeah, exactly. And I was thinking about this a lot as far as Nolan's quest to save film production. because when I was watching Interstellar, I was thinking this whole movie's about moving forward and finding new things. And Nolan's spending his entire press tour talking about how we should have stopped at film and not tried to make digital cameras the new thing, you know? And I felt like that was sort of this weird contradictory, path for the movie to be made on, but it is also, there is a strong theme of attachment in this film. Just remaining attached to something from your past and remaining attached to something that the best example of something, you know, like Cooper stays attached to Murph, you know, kind of like Nolan is staying attached to film production, and he feels like we kind of got to a point where we should stay attached to that and try to get bigger while still holding on to the things that we figured out work perfectly, you know. And I thought that was kind of interesting and still kind of contradictory, but I'm not going to tell Nolan how to make movies. He's figured it out.
Yeah, so that's kind of a contradictory on the kind of meta level, like we're talking about how he's doing his press tour versus the actual content of the movie.
Yeah, and as a fan of seeing things shot on film, like greens and blues just look way better on film. Like I think that's about as close to an objective fact as you can get with something so subjective. But I'm very pro film, but yeah, I mean it's definitely dying. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about some of the contradictions within this movie then?
How so?
Not a billion plot holes about science. There will be none of that on this podcast. okay, so this movie really values science. Like, in the production, Kip Thorne, the physicist who wrote the theories that a lot of this movie's based on and who was a consultant and producer on this movie, obviously they valued his scientific knowledge and scientific input and want to treat that, you know, well, and just kind of the value of science and how, you know, we should always be looking up and wondering and being pioneers and explorers and not, you know, looking down at the ground, wondering about our place here, to kind of paraphrase what Coop says. And just, you know, essentially one of the main points of this movie is how science is going to save us as a species. I don't think that's a stretch. But doesn't it also put a lot of stock into things like faith and feelings and accepting the unknown and just believing something without having scientific proof?
I think the movie sort of posits the theory that you just sort of have to figure that science will figure it out eventually. That's kind of, I think, what the movie is trying to get across. I think it's a bit muddy, but I think that's the idea that they want you to believe, you know?
That science will figure it out eventually.
Yeah, that like if we keep sort of plugging through with these theories, keep trying to solve these problems in a sort of objective scientific way, that they will eventually be able to be solved, and then we'll be able to create fifth dimensions to send Cooper back to Bookcase World, you know?
But I feel like so much of that is completely antithetical to what science is. Like so much of this movie is, they have all, they put all this faith in they. Something they can't really see or understand. And you get kind of the religious feeling through a lot of this movie about how, you know, all these, you know, the power of love, self-sacrifice, just believing in things that you can't see, putting all your stock in these other beings who we don't really have any understanding of. That just seems so counter-science.
But what I'm saying is what I think the movie says is plan B worked and plan B is what allowed Cooper to get back to Murphy. And it's just sort of that all of these things are happening simultaneously, blah, blah, blah. And yet, like I said, it's very muddy and I don't agree with it. I think I'm on your side. I'm just trying to explain what the film is trying to get you to believe. You know?
Yeah, no, and it's not that I am I bring up this point as someone who is anti-religious and super pro-science, I feel like it's just self-contradictory in that nature. And then, like, I know Nolan is upset that we're not actively trying to go to Mars, and that, you know, even in the real world, kind of science and exploring is being kind of brushed off to the side. And then in so much of this movie, it seems like to really be praising science and showing that that's kind of the absolute and what we need to pursue to, you know, thrive as a species. And then I also get a lot of kind of contradictory messages to that as well, but not to the point that that is what I feel hurts the movie the most.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like science will help us become better than human, basically. Yeah,
yeah, that's the takeaway?
I think so.
Okay. And love is the best thing ever?
I mean, yes, but don't ask me that question.
How'd you like the music? We've talked a lot about Nolan. You got to talk about Hans Zimmer.
I thought the music was quite great. I got a text message from our listener named Wiles, saying that he really liked this movie and loved the score. And he compared Nolan and Zimmer to sort of Belichick and Brady sort of situation. And I think that's pretty apt. I think they're so wonderful together. And I think Hans Zimmer is so important to this movie. This movie being as good as it is, as intense as it is, as enjoyable as it is. And I think the score throughout the film is good, but in the action sequences is fucking amazing. Like, and so important to the intensity of them, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm a fan of Hans Zimmer, and I can read them talk about each other for a long time. It's yeah. Really fun to me.
Yeah, for sure.
And did you see what Zimmer had said about kind of having to reinvent?
Yeah, they didn't want to do the booming drums or the big, like, loud percussive sounds that are very present in Inception and the Batman movies, right?
Yeah, and he said, to quote him directly, the textures, the music, and the sounds, the thing we sort of created has sort of seeped into other people's movies a bit, so it's time to reinvent. And, you know, we talked a while ago about how that the Inception sound really found its way into all this, the trailers and to all the soundtracks. And
yeah, four years later, it's still there.
Yeah. And it's just, it's, I mean, I'm not surprised that he's aware of that. I imagine he'd be much more aware of these things than we are. But it was cool to kind of hear him say that and say to go for something different. Tons of organ though, which again, kind of reminded me of the religious spiritual stuff that, I think that kind of always lends itself really well to space movies, but
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I don't know, a lot of kind of space movies, space epics like this kind of have that feeling of, you know, spirituality and things bigger than us, just because, you know, you're just dealing on such an epic scale.
Yeah, absolutely. And Hans Zimmer scores are always going to be bigger than us.
Yes, absolutely. let's talk about Murph, because I think she is a very, very, very central part of this movie.
I think so too.
Good acting, very impressed.
By which one?
Little Murph.
Okay, yeah, I like Little Murph.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah.
Is there a reason that Cooper does not seem to be a fan of his son at all, and only his daughter?
Yeah, that's never really explained. But yeah, I think we know which one is his favorite kid.
Yeah, that was always a little weird.
Yeah, and it's weird very early on, like when the tire pops on the truck, and he's like, it's his kid's name is Tom, right? The other kid, the kid we don't give a fuck about. Tom, fix it. And but we don't have another spare. Well, I'm not going to be around forever. Fix it. Fix it, you dumb farmer. And then he goes immediately to just console Murph and make sure Murph is doing okay, you know? And, I mean, right from there, you're kind of like, well, yep, this movie's not going to be about Tom.
Yeah. No, Coop is such like a warm, loving person throughout so much of this movie, unless his son is around.
Yeah, exactly. He loves everybody except that dumbass kid of his, you know?
Yeah, and I read that in the original script, like the first few drafts, Murphy's a boy.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know the working title of this movie as they were shooting it? Like the fake title?
Oh, yeah. It's Flora's Letter. Is that the name? Flora?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's Nolan's daughter. I think his most recent child, his fourth kid, his daughter's name.
Yeah. All like his last four movies have been named. Their working title has had one of the Nolan and Thomas, one of their four kids as a part of it. Yeah. Like, right. I think Magnus Rex was The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah. And Rory's first kiss.
Yeah.
So is that, do you think that the change of the gender of the child, that's, you know, one of the major parts of this movie, as the script changed on its way from Spielberg to Nolan, that's pretty much just because he's had a daughter? Like, is this, does that sound right to you? Or is it him just kind of doing things a little differently all the time, and that character would be the son most of the time if this movie is being made by other people?
I think it just means that this movie needed some female characters in it, and that was a way to get a female in the movie. I really strongly believe that there was just a total lack of women in this film, other than, well, I mean, now that Murph is a lady, presumably Amelia was always going to be a woman. But yeah, it's, you know, the female roles are pretty scarce in this film, and it just sort of, I don't know, allowed him to have another female. And it gave that nice sort of father-daughter thing that Dr. Brand has with Amelia as well. Sort of doubled that and kind of made them easier to compare. That's sort of nice little symmetry, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, because, you know, she leaves her dad, and then her Amelia leaves her dad, and then Murph is left by her dad. So it's kind of mirrored.
Yeah, exactly. Whole lot of daddy issues in this film.
Oh, tons of those. Yeah. Okay, so you don't think it was a personal thing with his daughter. Would you say that this is the most personal of Nolan's films so far?
I guess it's the most outwardly emotional, for sure, because it's the one where people talk about emotions the most.
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I feel weird answering that question for him. But yeah, it's certainly, I don't know, it's the most outwardly emotional. Yeah. But I think the fact that it is outwardly emotional kind of makes it less emotional to me, you know, because it wants you to know it's emotional as opposed to trusting you to find it yourself.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just thinking of Inception. Obviously, children were a big part of that. Like, that's the ending of that movie. It seems to be Dom's dark cob, whatever. I hate those names. you know, a lot of his drive for kind of the whole action of that movie is to be with his children again, and arguably his wife.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, now we have this daughter character, and just to think about Nolan as Cooper, he has a job that would take him away from his kids for very long periods of time. You know, obviously not to the degree that we see Cooper leave his children in this movie, but yeah, that was something I saw mentioned in a review, and I think you know, bears considering that he would be spending a lot of time away from his young daughter as well.
Yeah, exactly. And he's talked about that a bit, about how starting a film is, there's a lot of guilt involved in it because he knows he's not going to be able to be around his kids as much. Apparently the Nolan family is on set quite a bit, all things considered. And so he does see his kids more than I would suspect some directors are able to. Yeah, there is just the fact that even for Nolan, a guy that works considerably shorter days than most directors, his day is still 12 hours when he's shooting, you know?
Yeah.
And just a post-production process has so much involved. And yeah, it's very much a sort of guilt that, yes, you are embarking on this thing that is going to take so much of your time and so much of your energy that you could be giving to these kids, but you feel sort of this compulsion to do it. That is certainly a comparison or something worth thinking about that's in this movie. And he also said that a lot of the movie to him is about just trying to hold on to this time of basically when you become parent, apparently, I don't know, never happened to me, but like you're desperately always trying to hold on to these moments that are, seem to be going away from you way too fast. And those are sort of the two things that he really focused on as far as the parenting aspect, the guilt of leaving your child, and then the inability to hold on to the moments in your child's life that you want to see so dearly, you know?
Yeah, no, I can imagine that would be a very important factor in your life.
If you didn't have children. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you're right, though. Time is kind of the main villain in this movie. Like, it's something that is always present. You know, just the idea of going down to a planet for a few hours and losing a few decades back at home.
I love that. I love that so much.
Yeah, that is... It's a really cool part, and all the stuff about, you know, the relativity of time and things like and time dilation and time slippage like that, it really does create this really unique force in the movie. Like, you know, when they're trying to get off a planet, that still is exciting because, you know, they have to get off the planet, they have to be safe, they have to stay alive. But when you get this added factor of, yeah, even if you get out of here, like, there's these massive implications back at home. Like, it's even if you are here for 1 hour longer than you thought you would be, it has just such huge ramifications on the people you're trying to save and if you're ever going to see your child alive again. So it just escalates things so much. It just adds to the epic nature of this entire movie.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the scenes I really liked in the movie was sort of that scene in between the two action moments on the wave planet. The conversation between Brand and Cooper that happens right after Wes Bentley's character, whose name I forget, after he dies, and them quickly going over the situation that just happened, and also them reminding you that time is passing so much faster than you think it is, or the time that matters is passing so much quicker than you think it is. And that really helps elevate a conversation that is interesting and then also kind of becomes even more tension filled because you remember how their frustration is multiplied so much, you know? And I thought that was a really good scene, even removed from that. But anytime you're on the wave planet and you just sort of remember, oh yeah, an hour is 7 years. It adds a real level of intensity. Yeah, and that's like the first time we hear percussion in the score is the second they get on the wave planet, and just sort of really ratchets it up a little bit. You know?
Yeah. Just in that discussion, just when they both kind of realize how long it's really been back on Earth, and you just see their hearts sinking and they can't even fathom what they've missed. Like, they know it's devastating, but they're not even aware of like what a crazy shock this really is to what their life is going to be. And that's, you know, just that time dilation thing that is throughout this movie, just, as I said, just adds such an element to it and just magnifies everything and every move they make because of, you know, what it means for the people back home that they're trying to save.
Yeah, absolutely.
As I was going to say with the idea of time, I liked the circular space shuttle and the way that it's always rotating, and you get this kind of clock-like movement, and just in the background things are always spinning and just giving you this idea that, you know, time is passing. And you know, even when it's not central and you just look out the a window in the background of a scene and you see these stars like flying by so quickly, and you just think of you know, the ticking clock of Earth, and just how quickly things are moving. And it's just a kind of this constant reminder, because there's a lot of windows that you do see the sky or space, whatever, during a lot of these discussions. And it's just this reminder that things are just always moving, always going.
Oh man, the visual storytelling in this movie, just, I agree with everything you said, but the visual storytelling of this film is just, it's top notch. Like, it's so great. You know, it's so much gets across visually, and is so, so wonderful. And I love that, you know, and I think it's great in this movie. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, and it's the passage of time and the loneliness that gets to Dr. Mann that makes him do these really kind of terrible things to Coop and Amelia to try to get them to stay, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, because his motivation is basically that he needed to be saved, and then he needed to go save the planet. You know, like, he didn't want to just give up his life, so he went down for the long nap and left his beacon on or whatever. And then once he realizes Cooper's going to go home instead of going through with plan B. He's like, oh no, I have to get to the Endurance so that I can make plan B happen. I'm correct in that being his motive, right?
Yeah, that's my understanding at least.
Yeah. And I thought that was kind of interesting, and his whole talk about the survival instinct, which is an idea that is very present throughout this movie, just the idea of the human survival instinct, even just on the first 40 minutes or however long it is until Cooper goes into space, just the idea of how humans choose to survive, whether they choose to just sort of exist in a world that in the world that they have, or and just, you know, sort of run out the time until they die, or try and actively make things better. And there's a lot of talk of inaction versus action in this film. Most of the characters that we spend any time with focus more on the action side of things. But yeah, I think that's really interesting. And the fact that Mann feels like Cooper is going to go back to Earth instead of trying to make plan B happen is basically what drives him to murder people. And he feels like what he's doing is right. And honestly, he might be, you know, and I think that that's kind of the interesting, one of the really interesting things about this movie is survival is so important. And so is, I find the way this movie deals with honesty totally fascinating. I
find it 90% fascinating.
Okay, great. I see you've got your humor levels turned up to 100%.
Tars to honesty was at 90, remember?
Yeah, no, I know.
Okay.
that was what we call a joke, James. But yeah, I think the way that this movie treats honesty is really fascinating. Like the idea of what Cooper talks about, lying to his kids to keep them safe, or make them feel safe, sorry. Him talking with Amelia just after they've lifted off, and her basically telling him that, you know, just we need to know when to talk and when to not, like that honesty. You've got to keep your honesty at a certain level to maintain sort of functionality as a unit. And then also the idea of lying for survival, which Dr. Brand, Michael Caine, Dr. Brand, and Matt Damon's character do. And they feel that being dishonest is totally okay as long as it serves the greater good. And there's certainly some muddy ethics involved there, but it's really fascinating. Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, there's, I was going to ask you what you thought of Mann's little speech about how Professor Brand really made such a huge sacrifice, and Amelia and Cooper obviously kind of take umbrage to that and feel that they are the ones making the sacrifice. Yeah, no, it's definitely not an honesty is the best policy, and that's that kind of movie at all.
Yeah, exactly.
There's tons of, as you said, kind of muddy waters to navigate. So, yeah, that's something that, I mean, it never really gets a clear answer. It seems like maybe lying sometimes is what this movie is saying is the right thing to do. But, yeah, there's certainly a lot of play there. And it seems like we're really supposed to dislike Dr. Mann just because he's sometimes actively acting against our protagonist. But it does seem like we are supposed to like... we're supposed to like Professor Brand and his decisions, right?
Yeah.
So it just seems weird that he's backing him up, and there's kind of a break in the way that we feel about those two.
Yeah, exactly. And it's certainly in the moment of the movie, I mean, Mann very quickly becomes the villain because he is the person that pushes our hero. But yeah, when you sort of think about their motives, you start to realize that they're kind of just, they're more on the same, they're closer together than you initially think. It's just we've spent more time with one of them than the other. And, I mean, Michael Caine making a heel turn is always going to surprise people, you know?
But I feel like this movie tries to have it both ways because it's not really a heel turn.
No, that's exactly correct. I don't think it is either. But I think the way a lot of people perceive it, it's like, oh, my God, he sent them to their death, you know? That's the way I think the moment is kind of delivered. It's this moment of very strong importance, and he's crying while he's saying it, and I agree. I think he knew what he was doing, and he knew he was doing a terrible thing to his daughter, and just blatantly lying to her, but he felt it was worth it. I think the thing that the movie doesn't get across
as well is the fact that is why they felt it was worth it, you know?
Why they felt what was worth it?
The lying.
Oh, okay.
Like Mann and Professor Brand, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Amelia.
Yeah.
We talked about how Murph might be an opportunity to get another female character in there.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard Nolan criticized for not being able to write women very well.
Okay. Well, I mean, he's never really written a really good character. Like, you know, like it's just his movies feature more men than women. So people feel that men are better represented, which they are, like, physically. But it's not, I think every character in this movie is written about the same and that they're all very broad strokes, you know? There is not a lot of depth to most Nolan characters. You know?
Yeah, and is that problematic for you at all, or in this movie in particular?
No, because I'm cold and hate people. I'm in it for ideas, you know?
Yeah. I've just stuck on the idea that he is this kind of cold filmmaker, and then his latest thing is so much about love and warmth and things like that. So much of that stuff doesn't really work for me either. Like, there's just chunks of this movie of people talking back and forth that are just some groan-worthy dialogue or performances or something. Like, there are some bad pieces in this movie.
Yeah, I agree. But the things that I like quite a bit. I like that honesty stuff. I like the idea of the survival instinct, the differing paths of the survival instinct that I explained. But yes, you are correct. It's a very uneven movie. But I think the wheat is worth the chaff, you know?
Yeah, it's... I think there's a way to kind of get both and to do these things and still have interesting characters. I don't know why he can't do that. And some of the main characters don't have much dimensions to them. And then some of the minor characters, like, I don't know Topher Grace's name. I've seen this movie twice in the past few days. Like, there's tons of stuff. I have no idea who these people are. They're just so, they're so bland. Like, to describe any of these characters, it's impossible. There's nothing to them.
Yeah, I agree entirely. I'm just saying, like, some people are good at making movies about people, and some people are good at making movies about ideas. You know, that Nolan's just not great at everything.
Yeah, it just seems like he doesn't even try to make movies about people.
And that's why I love him. And I think that's the biggest problem with this movie is that he does kind of try to make a movie about he tries to make the movie that addresses his flaws, and he fails. The things that he fails at are the things that he's trying to address that he hasn't really addressed well in his career. That sort of coldness perception. And that's the failure of this movie. And sometimes it's better to just accept your flaws and put yourself in a position to succeed, you know?
Okay. Yeah, it's just...
Because, he's made great movies with... I mean, we talked about Memento. There's nothing to Leonard, you know?
But he's supposed to be a blank slate because of his condition.
Okay, well, I mean, do you care about Alfred Borden or whatever Batman and Wolverine's names are in The Prestige? I didn't care about them at all. That movie's super legit, you know?
Yeah.
So it really doesn't matter, you know, to me. If you're doing one thing well enough that I can forget about the other thing, then that's fine. The problem with this movie is that Nolan tries to have it all, to steal phrases from this film, and he just does not succeed.
Okay. One thing I think you probably did like about the love aspect and the interpersonal aspect of this movie is that we have a male and female lead character who don't kiss at any point.
5 stars.
It's a very... for a movie that's so much about love, it's so little about romance and, like, sexual love. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's
and Nolan tends
to very bland love.
Yeah, exactly. And Nolan does make pretty asexual movies, for the most part. But I agree. And I think there is sort of some implication of they imply a little bit of will they, won't they, but it's mostly just because when Cooper gets to Plan B planet, it's going to be sort of an Adam and Eve situation more than anything, you know?
Yeah, and it's Yeah, that's kind of always present. Like, for a movie that mentions specifically, like, repopulating the Earth and things like, or repopulating a planet and things like that, it's so not sexy. And I don't mean that it tries to be sexy and fails. It's just not part of this.
Exactly. But, I mean, Cooper spends so much of the movie in a place where starting to repopulate the planet would be incredibly irresponsible, you know?
That's true.
Yeah.
And I don't know if Anne Hathaway can get her hands out of her pockets long enough to have sex with anyone.
You leave Anne Hathaway alone. She's been through enough.
Ugh, no. This is when she lost me. I know the world turned on her a while ago, but I did not enjoy her at all in this.
Fine.
You did like her?
She has some of the worst lines in the movie, but I don't think she's the problem.
Yeah, that's not her fault.
No, I think Jessica Chastain's really bad in this movie.
Do you?
I like Jessica Chastain. I think she's really great in Tree of Life, and I thought she was pretty good in Zero Dark Thirty. But, oh man, she's bad in this movie.
She's kind of doing Zero Dark Thirty again in this.
What? Oh, she just doesn't feel right. She doesn't seem right. The way she talks to Professor Brand, it's very much like she's talking to like a grandmother that she loves and is about to die. And she's listening. I don't know. It's just weird. She's listening for the wisdom and not the actual science. You know, I don't know. It's just weird.
Yeah.
The way she looks at Michael Caine, it wasn't right. The way she yells, I mean, her yelling Eureka was fucking stupid anyway, but I suppose that one's not on her. But even when she's just standing and looking at chalkboards, she does not look like she knows what's happening, you know.
Yeah, I'll agree with the woman sitting behind you, was it? I did think when he comes back and watches all those transmissions for the first time, and you know, you see Murph's face pop up eventually, I thought that was emotionally impactful, but not to the point I was crying like this woman was.
Oh yeah, and she didn't even get, she before Tom even showed up on screen, she was crying. I will say I know I mentioned earlier in this podcast, the second people start crying in movies is basically the second I tune out of the emotion of the scene. But I did think Matthew McConaughey's performance in the first shot of that scene, as he's sitting down and like kind of smiling and starting to cry at the message, I thought that was really good, and kind of a different way from to show that sort of thing than you typically see. And I thought that was really great.
Yeah, and just like I said before, where you're watching them have that discussion where they kind of realize how much time has passed, and you know, you can tell they can't really fathom it. That's kind of the same thing. Like, he sees Tom now as, you know, a middle-aged man with a kid and things like that.
His voice has gotten higher with the years.
Yeah, right. you know, and that's kind of the same thing. Like,
he missed a grandchild's entire life.
Oh yeah, poor
as short
Jesse,
as it was.
Eh?
Yeah.
Ugh, yikes. Yeah, I thought that was kind of a good way to, you know, do a lot really quickly and show how much you've missed, which would be where you would imagine these characters' minds would be constantly when they're not running for their life.
And I thought the transition to adult Murph out of that was really, really awesome. Like, as the as she ends her transmission is when we first get back to Earth with a grown-ass Murph, you know. I enjoyed that. Yeah. Quite a bit. And then we get back to the spaceship with sort of a reverse of that, with Michael Caine going to talk to his daughter through the message, and I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah, and as
so it sort of connects these things in a way that makes the more jump cutty versions of that later on easier to swallow, basically.
Yeah, no, I was gonna say, as much as I have a hard time with the realism of her not communicating with her father that she clearly loved very much from the ages of, like, between the ages of 10 and Jessica Chastain age.
Yeah.
I did kind of like her little video about how she's as old as he was when he left and all that. Like, I thought that was, again, if you kind of overlook the fact that she would never wait that long after that to make some kind of communication with him.
Yeah.
It's a nice little part of the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we've talked about it a bit. I thought the theme that we haven't really discussed that much is the theme of attachment, and I think it ties in a lot to the visual storytelling of this film that I like so much. I mean, we got a little bit of the linking with the video messages there, but the way cameras are attached to the ships in this movie, I mean, I assume you noticed it because it's so frequent. Like, anytime a vehicle is traveling, very frequently we'll get a shot of a camera that is, or, you know, a shot where the camera is very clearly attached to the physical thing that is flying through the air. We get it first with Cooper's Dream, and then all throughout the movie. When he's driving away from his family, we see a camera attached to his truck, and then we get the liftoff, which I thought another great transition. I really enjoyed.
Yeah, that was cool.
Yeah, very good. It's like once he's left home, he is left home. You know, I like that a lot. I thought that was really great, and the idea of sort of attaching these cameras to these vehicles sort of adds to the theme of traveling in the film, the theme of exploration. You are progressing further with as these things progress further, and we get IMAX cameras that are attached to Anne Hathaway like a GoPro in this movie, which is crazy. Those cameras are heavy, and they move with the characters at times. That doesn't happen until later on in the film, but the theme of attachment I felt like was really, really nailed home with the way cameras are nailed into these vehicles, you know.
Yeah, no, I hadn't thought of that, but that's a good point. You know, there's tons of shots of kind of the wings as the ships are banking in the air, and you know, you just go with it, like you're just fixed to this wing and kind of watching the world around you as you travel with these characters with this vehicle.
Exactly, and I do think there was kind of a practical element to that too, as far as like from the viewer, because I think on an IMAX screen, if there wasn't something that was static during a lot of these sequences, a lot of those close-up shots of the ships and whatnot, it would have been pretty hard to take. Like, it would have made you pretty queasy. So having something there that is static in the frame, even though there's all this movement going on around it, you know this thing will be a constant and will help you not vomit. And I thought that was an interesting decision. But I wanted to ask you about the shot of the Endurance after is it Romilly
bearded
guy, the after he gets his the headphones from Cooper, and we see him listening to the sound of this rainstorm, and we get the shot from outside of the Endurance with this it's spinning, and it's just this very wide big shot of space. What did you think about that shot with the rain sound effects still playing throughout it?
Oh, yeah, I love that one. Sorry, okay. It took me a minute to remember what you mean. And this is not the first movie to do it. Sorry, not that, but what I'm about to describe. You know, 2001 Space Odyssey does it. Some other good space movies do it. Just having these big, wide shots and absolute silence, and, you know, the way that they say, you know, there is no sound in space, really. it's just the epic nature of this movie gets driven home when you see these little tiny dots of the ship traveling through this just massive open void, or in front of another planet, in front of Saturn or something. That's good. And then when you have music as well made as Hans Zimmer tends to make music, those things are just kind of those moments that, like, when I think of just the classic, like, reasons to go to the movie, it's those big epic shots where you're in a room with hundreds of people and it's just absolutely silent, and you're all just taking in this, like, the massive scale of what you're looking at, you know, of the epic nature of the story and just the visual effects. It's great. And it's Christopher Nolan trying to get bigger and bigger every time. I don't know what he's going to do next, but, it's so big and it's so grand, and it's just kind of these moments where, like, you forget you're watching a movie and you just get so into something, and so little is actually happening at those moments. It's just the ship continuing to go forward and
time continuing to pass, you know.
Yeah, and little to no audio, but then just the scale of this, and like just this mission that they're on, just how grand it is and the implications of everything. And there's just these kind of just these silent moments where you're just in a theater with all these strangers, and it's just like this really breathtaking thing that is what Nolan, I think, right now at this point in his career is like trying to maximize and trying to have these big moments and these big events, and why all his movies continue to expand.
Yeah, exactly. Going back to that shot with the addition of the rain sound effects, I think that kind of I enjoyed that shot because I think it sort of helped attach the Endurance back to Earth. Just because you get these, it's a weird juxtaposition, but you know, that's why Cooper's listening to these sound effects, to sort of feel like he's more attached to Earth. And that's why Romilly is now listening to these sound effects to sound more attached to Earth. And so it's interesting that we then see them and this score, or not score, but these sound effects that we are hearing, apart from them, we also get that sort of attachment. I thought that was really interesting. And you're right about the sequence of Nolan trying to make these movies as big as possible. And to do that, but he also doesn't want to sacrifice some of the storytelling to do that. The sequence that I think is just about the best thing in the universe is the fight with Maddie Mann. That whole sequence from when they start their hand-to-hand combat to when Romilly explodes, to evil Matt taking off, to good Matt being saved, to evil Matt failing to dock, and yeah, him exploding. And then that sequence is wonderful. And then there's maybe 3 seconds in between that and Matthew McConaughey saying, or somebody, I assume it's Amelia, asking him, what are we doing? And him saying docking, and the organs kicking in, and fucking you lose your goddamn mind. It's wonderful. But going to back to that visual storytelling, as soon as he says docking and the organs start swelling, we cut to this wide shot of the ship and the Endurance. The Endurance is falling apart. It's spinning out of control. It is there. It is the thing that they have to attach to in order to continue to survive. And it is literally spinning out of control and falling apart in front of their eyes. And
they're literally trying to attach to it. Yeah.
Exactly. And and Cooper's just immediately, his survival instinct kicks in. He's like, this is the thing we have to do. Otherwise, we'll just do nothing until we die. And that's why I think that sequence is so amazing. It also ties into the whole thing about Nolan feeling there are imperceptible things that we feel as an audience, because that's certainly not something I was thinking about in the moment. The first time I was watching that scene, I was thinking, this is awesome. This is awesome. Oh my God, he's spinning.
In an action movie kind of way.
Yeah, exactly. But once it's over and you get that sort of like moment of release, and it's just it's so amazing. And then you're like, oh, that encapsulated the entire story. Their planet is losing control. It's falling apart, and they need to get back to it. They need to attach to it. And this sort of feeling of attachment is prevalent all throughout the movie, with the cameras attached to the ships, with Cooper trying to get back to Murph because he's so attached to her, and just all of the docking that happens in this movie. Like, you just need something to be attached to, something to live for, something to continue on. And I think that sequence captures everything that's great about this movie in one. And like you were saying about that feeling of bigness that Nolan tries to get, when I saw that movie the second time, like, I was still getting amped up about it. And after that sequence ended, it's like, I would have paid $100 for that movie ticket. And but I like to guarantee that I'm getting that feeling, you know, but because it's so rare, right? Like the hallway sequence in Inception is another good example of that. Or in The Dark Knight Rises, really tying into the story, Bruce Wayne climbing out of the prison. That sort of like feeling where everything that you love about film comes together. And that's the thing that Nolan's very conscious of, and tries to do this once a movie. And it's great, and I do kind of pay hundreds of dollars for that ticket because I very rarely get it. But when it does happen, like it does in Interstellar, you could have had a 2-hour monologue about love leading into it, and I would have still been fine with this movie's existence.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, the themes that this movie has that are good, like honesty, survival, and attachment, I think are really strong and really good. Yeah.
Yeah. And just the constant presence of gravity, you know, obviously they're in space for a lot of it and there is no gravity, but just talking about gravity and how it's the one thing that, you know, they can communicate with and understand. And, you know, what's gravity more than just two things being attracted to each other and attaching, right? Like it's another force that just promotes attachment, and it's, you know, what allows him to communicate with Murph and save the world, blah blah blah. Okay, I got some questions for you.
Okay.
Was Coop born 40 years too early or too late?
I'm going to go with too late.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any particular reason?
No.
Okay. Next question. Is this movie Steven Spielberg plus M. Night Shyamalan? Daddy issues, big budget, twists.
Well, I mean, Nolan movies have a lot more father figures than I think people talk about. It's certainly more obvious in Spielberg movies, but Batman.
Mike Caine being in everything.
Well, and Batman is built around daddy issues.
Parent issues.
Yeah, yeah. Bruce Wayne's mom has zero lines. You know, we've talked about this. Yeah. Yes, sure.
Okay, great.
Well, I mean, you're asking me these questions that I could think about and then maybe give an answer to, but like my immediate reaction is no, it's a Nolan movie where he tries to be too emotional. That's my, which I suppose is a Spielberg movie.
There it is. What's Cooper's first name?
I don't know. Okay. Gary?
Matthew is correct. No, I don't know.
I do love the name Murphy Cooper. I think that's the funniest name.
Why? Because it's two last names again?
No, it's just silly. Like, it's just so silly.
Oh my God. He needs to learn how to name characters.
It's not that bad in this movie.
I'm like Amelia Romilly.
That's a last name, though.
Okay. Is it?
I don't know. They don't focus that much on him. You get Dr. Topher.
Yeah, who was that? What was Topher about?
I don't know, but the people beside me the first time I saw it got a big kick out of his presence.
Oh, I am a huge Topher Grace fan and happy he was there, but I just part of like the things that Nolan doesn't want to focus on in this movie, I think being really underdeveloped.
Okay, well, like here's my thing with the with stuff like that where since it's Topher Grace, you feel like that character is supposed to be somebody that you know something about because you know things about Topher Grace, right? And it's the same thing with Dr. Mann. When we see Matt Damon, people are confused. They're like, why is Matt Damon in this movie? Why don't I know Matt Damon's in this movie? Because when you see a movie with Matt Damon is in it, you know he's going to be in it beforehand, right?
Yeah.
And the reason I think that Nolan is... does these things, and even I think Casey Affleck's underused in this movie. And
yeah, he is, because yeah. He's a great actor, does nothing in this.
Yeah, exactly. But the reason that Nolan does things like this and casts people in these roles that maybe are smaller than what they typically play and, you know, could be better used in a different movie where they have a larger role, the reason he does this is because I strongly suspect he hates the casting process because he likes to move quickly and casting is not a quick process typically. Whereas he knows that if Matt Damon is going to say yes to playing Dr. Mann, he knows he's got a good actor and he doesn't need to test them, doesn't need to screen test them. It obviously helps the movie that we don't know Dr. Mann is going to be a character we see when we're going into space. And it obviously helps the movie that it's a good actor. And an actor that Nolan didn't have to exhaustively screen test so that he could then put his time into other things that help the movie, like the visual effects, right? And yeah. that same thing exists on a much smaller level for Topher Grace. He knows, like, if you see Topher Grace in something, you know he can manage that part. You know, he plays it in Traffic. You know he can do it. So sure, we've got Topher Grace. We don't have to do a screen test for this actor. We know he's good. Cast him. And I think that's why we get so many repeats in Nolan movies.
That's what I was going to say. Exactly. Just take his cast list from his last movie.
Once he finds somebody that he knows he can work with and works well with him, he'll keep them around. The voice of Case was one of Bane's henchmen. It's just sort of anything to help him keep up his pace. He really believes in this sort of momentum behind filmmaking. That's why he works quickly and tries to light areas instead of tiny specific shots whenever possible, so these actors have space to really work within. He just likes to keep that momentum up, and I think by casting these people he knows are good without having to screen test them, it's great. You know, like he loves it. And yeah. I think helps the movie way more than that 3 seconds of what the fuck? Why is Matt Damon in this movie? You know, it's way more helpful than it is hurtful. Yeah.
Yeah. Even if it's distracting for a small amount of time, you're like, okay, well, he's in it. What the fuck's happening in the movie now?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Quick comparison to Gravity, the movie. Go.
Interstellar is a better movie.
Okay.
Gravity is a more focused movie. But it's that sort of focus that I think I would rather have a messier Interstellar than a more focused but kind of thematically boring Gravity.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where does Christopher Nolan go from here? As I said, like, this is so big. I don't know how you get bigger. Like, this is 80 years and I don't know, galaxies of travel. Very epic scale. And he seems to have been going up and up, right? Like, Inception was really big, different, you know, timelines. But yeah, I think if anyone's seen the movie, they know it's a very big movie. I'll stop there.
Yeah. He'll find a way. He always has.
Okay. To get back up again.
Exactly.
Okay. I think that's almost all I have.
Okay. Yeah, I don't have anything else. I mean, we talked about Topher Grace, so we got all the things crossed that I need to get across.
Awesome.
Thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man.
Don't leave me like this, Alex. Don't make me leave you like this, Alex. I'm crying with one of my eyes closed way more than the other one right now.
Okay. Detach.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.